Thank you so much, Mark. That was very interesting. And we have a good amount of time now for a Q&A and discussion session. And also just to point out that we have 74 participants joining us online, which is really fantastic. So thank you all for joining us on the webinar. We'll alternate Q&A between our webinar audience and our in-person audience. And when you ask a question or make a comment, we just ask that you state your name and organization and also use the microphone. And I think it works a little bit better if you kind of angle it towards your mouth rather than hold it up and down like this. Microphones are tricky. So are there any clarifying
questions?
That's
a really good point. Yeah. If you could just please hold the microphone close to your mouth. I know it sounds great here in the room, but this is mainly for the webinar participants. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Adam. All right, we have one back here.
Hi, my name is Barry Hoffman. I'm with the Bureau of Food Security at USAID. I was just curious, in this study, could you explain to me the definitions that you used for precision agriculture and organic agriculture? I just wanted to know exactly what you meant by those.
Yeah, okay. Let me go back to the start here if I can. Oops. Make sure I say it right. The question is, how did we define precision agriculture and organic agriculture? And I can refer you also to the slide. So precision agriculture is GPS-assisted delivery of agriculture inputs with respect to, you know, measurements of the field. So you tailor water applications to where there's less water within your field profile. Fertilize, you know, you do sampling of the nutrient levels to get at how much fertilizer you should put in and so forth. But we're not saying it has to be the large scale tractors that say the U.S. has or Brazil has. There's already developing some much smaller scale tractor systems and GPS systems, and even handheld, that help you target some of these in developing countries. So we're not expecting sort of a leapfrogging of, say, a small farmer in India to a full large-scale system, but with various kinds of intermediate technologies, but that do these kinds of GPS-assisted delivery. Organic, is, you know, so it's cultivation without the use of manufactured pesticides, fertilizers, growth regulators, or GMOs as well.
In the organic agriculture, are there other inputs that are added to those crops versus the conventional crops that are grown with, I mean?
Yeah, so what we do, we take the profile of existing organically managed rice, wheat, and maize so that it has compost residues and so forth as well as it has a higher use of labor also in management of the crops as well.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
And we've got a question from online.
Question from our online. Sorry.
Yeah, this one is from Robert Navin, USAID Africa Bureau. Increasing yields are necessary but not sufficient. Have studies conducted financial analyses such as cost-benefit analysis to see what is profitable for different sizes of farms?
They're saying, did we do it in this particular study?
This one just says, the question just said studies. So if you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's essential as well. We weren't able to do detailed cost-benefit studies for each of these. We did do it in assessing the adoption pathways. We had broad estimates using expert judgment of the profitability by region of the different crops. But that would be another step forward, I think, in terms of the scaling up process to then get an additional handle on the exact cost-benefit parameters within a given locality, for example, in Africa.
Thank you. My name is Rafik Naybrook. I'm an employee with Conservation International. I work for Vital Science. It's a project that looks at sort of the trade-offs between agricultural intensification, ecosystem services, human well-being. It's nice to see the DSET models being used so widely now. I did my master's in 1997 on this, and so it's really nice to see this. But my question is sort of on the model used. I'm not sure if you could do this at the scale that you work, but it's two parts of the question. Were forested areas and critical biodiversity areas included in the sort of suitability for crop growth and yield increase. And the second part of this is, were you able to use the models and perhaps tweak the variables a little bit to show that especially water and pest management would improve due to the ecosystem benefits from forest areas, so that you could show the importance of sort of natural areas and keeping natural areas, and that they're an important part of sustainable intensification. Mm. Thanks.
Okay, great questions. Yeah, we explicitly excluded any kind of forested area or park area, I think, from the suitable areas for production, so that our null hypothesis is we wouldn't go into those. In fact, as you see, the results show that there's savings of anywhere from 20% to 30% of cropped area under these technologies writ large. So that there is no encroachment in the analysis on say forested areas. We don't have that particular analysis yet. We're doing some work now with ICRAF, the International Center for Agroforestry and headquarters in Kenya, on whether we can't use a farming system approach in more detail to get at those kinds of linkages that where better management of forest and agroforestry can affect also the yields. That's not part of this particular report. Thanks.
Hi, my name is John War, and I'm with Integra. I'm staggered by the amount of work that you've put into this. It's a really interesting study, and I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to read it in advance. But a cursory glance I couldn't find very much information on the assumptions that you made about the impacts of elevated CO2 levels on agricultural productivity and also on weeds.
Yeah, so we do have the CO2 impacts are embedded in the on crop yield are embedded in the climate change scenario. So they're within the baseline scenario that they're included, but we don't have the impact on weeds, and that's another area who I think needs a lot more work is looking at the impacts over time of climate change, not only on weeds but on pests and diseases. The data isn't out there yet where we thought we could implement it in this phase. It's something that I think would really be an extremely important additional step in this kind of analysis.
Sure. For I would refer you to work of Lou Ziska at the Agricultural Research Service as a good place to start
great.
On that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, Lou's doing great work.
All right, we'll run over to our online audience, and then I'll get you next.
This question comes from Agatha Sector, a natural resources officer at USAID Senegal. Were estimated adoption rates used in the model? No-till technology has been around, but not easily adopted for a variety of reasons, including labor costs, a lack of understanding. And then the question was seconded by Philippe Chabot, who asks, can the presenter talk a bit about the transferability of no-till? This is a system usually used with large machinery. How easily is this transferred to smallholder systems?
Yeah, it's not real easy. There is, though, now a number of initiatives underway to use no-till with smaller scale, the hand tractors or much smaller tractors. And I think AID may be exploring some of that, but I'm not sure. So it's not easy, and we have the adoption rates of no-till under the they vary a lot by region. I think the highest rate of adoption we have is about 40% or 50%, I believe, in some regions, but I'd have to double check that. So we did take into account the difficulty of adoption of the different technologies. But on the other hand, we don't feel that necessarily what's happening today is the final story on that. That there is potential, there are things going on to improve the extension of these technologies.
We'll get a question back here.
Thanks. I'm Rob Neuter with the International Fertilizer Development Center. I was pleased to see the results you had for ISFM and NUE technologies. These are things we've been working on. One that you didn't study is the use of urea or fertilizer deep placement.
Yeah.
And we have found with our work in Bangladesh in particular on rice this to get very positive 20% increases in yields and so forth. And we're now looking at compound fertilizers on upland cereals, and that's showing also very positive effects. Have you, did you look at that at all, or is there any way to start to incorporate that into your thinking here?
And it's certainly something we could look at. I mean, with, you know, resource and time constraints, we couldn't hit every technology, obviously. But, yeah, I've seen the literature on your work, and, yeah, it looks like a what I've seen is very positive impacts as well, but we haven't done it here.
We have an online question.
Yes, there's two sort of technical questions. One from Daudou Ndiaye, a regional agriculture specialist from the Sahel Regional Office in USAID Senegal. In dryland areas, are there specific cover crops that are adapted that don't compete for resources with commodity crops, or are there other available technologies like mulch that might be more successful? And the second technical question is from Solomon Foll. Nitrogen is the focus of the fertility management in the presentation. Why was phosphorus not included?
Well, and the second one, again, is really just a resource issue that we focused on nitrogen there. I mean, phosphorus is obviously a big issue as well, and with significant concerns that obviously of shortages or much higher prices of phosphorus in the future. It just, again, we weren't able to do everything here. The cover crops, again, were not directly modeled when we modeled a scenario such as integrated soil fertility management. The assumption was the availability of crop residues from the crop produced there, as well as composting from row crops that combined with those technologies. But we didn't, say, do a complete modeling of mulching or rotation systems.
Hi there. I'm John McMurdy. I'm also from the Bureau of Food Security at USAID. I have two questions. Maybe the first question would be interesting for folks to hear, was kind of more general. What was the kind of the process for prioritizing which technologies you included in the study, which were in, which were out? And the second was kind of a more specific question. I saw in the presentation discussing the impacts of no-till. It was, you know, very heavy on wheat and maize, but no impact on rice. Was that something that was not included, or just all of this work on direct seeding and rice didn't come out to be beneficial, which is scarier for what everyone's doing in South Asia. Is it worth it or not?
Yeah, we didn't look at the combination of direct seeding with no-till. I guess we didn't visualize that as a completely perhaps we should have. Yeah, so this is not an evaluation of direct seeding what we have here. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the overall, I mean, a lot of it was due to, you know, expert judgment, discussion with, you know, within and with, you know, with the advisory panel as well, as to what we thought would be the higher potential technologies. But we also wanted to get a range of technologies that included not just sort of high science technologies, but also farm-based cropping systems as well. So we wanted a range of types of systems, but one that seemed to have significant potential as well. So, and, you know, by nature, though, it's limited. We could do a lot more of this, but if you want to send us another grant. So. Yeah, I think there's a lot of potential. We've heard several questions here that already indicate the potential for additional work that could be done along these lines. So.
And so just, a follow-up question, and this is a question, I guess, partially for you, partially for CropLife, the funders, whomever, or, you know, what do you view as some of the uses of this kind of work? Is it, you know, working really to kind of push this information out to post-country governments? I mean, certainly people like us can, you know, speaking from the USAID folks, benefit tremendously, but sort of other areas where you want to kind of utilize this information to drive changes in behavior.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking both at sort of the international organization level, so we're making a number of presentations to the World Bank, the UN agencies in Rome, a number of major conferences around the world that bring people and private sector together also. So we're also reaching out to the private sector. Then we also plan to get these results out. In fact, we're already doing that in some of our projects at the country level in the developing countries. I think it would be a great, for example, to take up a lot of these results in the technology platform work we're doing with AGRA. And so we see that as a very natural extension. and providing parameters for, you know, where potential technologies are, and so target areas for actual case study approaches then to taking this the next step to scaling up.
This question was asked by two folks at Peace Corps, actually, Kevin Pfaff, a volunteer in Jamaica, and Daniel Stormer, a Peace Corps food security program assistant in Senegal. Which of these adaptive technologies are most easily adopted by smallholder farmers? Of those that have or likely will have a slow rate of adoption, what approach or which actors do you feel will diffuse the innovations best?
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, the easiest ones to adopt once they're developed are the improved seed varieties, and that's, you know, things like drought tolerance, heat tolerance, and nitrogen use efficiency, because they're embedded in the seeds. So essentially, they're turnkey technologies. But then, of course, the constraint there is getting these technologies to develop for the conditions in developing countries. And there is, I think, encouraging work going on in Africa and in many countries in Asia to bring sort of characteristics of, say, heat tolerance and drought tolerance and adapt it to the background varieties that have the highest potential in the individual countries. So I think, you know, heat tolerance is already being tested. I'm sorry, drought tolerance is being tested in a number of countries, in developing countries, and I think significant improved varieties will be available in the next 3 to 4 years. I think nitrogen use efficiency and heat tolerance are a little bit further down the line, but the progress is very substantial. So once those are available, rolling them out is relatively easy, assuming that you have decent seed systems. And of course, that's another area that has to be worked on is appropriate and improved seed distribution systems in developing countries. I think, you know, we heard already there's concerns about no-till. So I think, again, that needs to be better adapted to local regions, but local areas. But if those technologies can be adapted, it could be relatively straightforward. Precision agriculture, again, it needs some development because, to get at the what you might call low-tech precision agriculture. Though the other aspects you're seeing is in parts of Asia and Latin America is that you're seeing consolidation of farm management sizes, not of farm holdings. So you still have small holders owning the farms, but you're seeing increasingly that the farms are organized as somewhat are managed at somewhat higher level, higher farm size, and then contracting out services like for example in India, laser land levying is being done on contract basis as well as various kinds of plowing services. But again, some adaptation is necessary. Let me see what else we've got here. So again, I'm not, all of these will need some work, but you know, several of them I think are ready to move out fairly rapidly, but you do need to work in the local regions. And I think in terms of who can do it, I think you know, extension systems in many of the areas we all work in, the public ones are essentially broken. So I think you need to do a much more combination of work with NGOs that are working in the specific areas, to some extent with private companies that have an incentive to promote, for example, improved seed varieties. They've been effective in some regions, and you're seeing, I think, some useful partnerships between private sector and NGOs in region in regions as well. So I think it's, you know, obviously it's a complex thing and to roll these out. The other area, other things you need to do, of course, is to improve rural infrastructure investment in many of these areas, such as in Africa, to improve access to markets and to these kinds of technologies and inputs as well. So it's obviously a complex process, but again, I think most of these technologies are on the way to being adapted or are already adapted to developing country situations and can be moved out.
Question back here.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Foster with the Energy Division at USAID. Thank you very much for sharing the findings. I also have a question about the next steps in terms of adoption strategy. Very interested about the energy inputs and the costs associated with that with adopting new technologies. And outside of irrigation and water harvesting and pumping, from your own experience, where have you seen those technologies that you think will require the most or most energy intensive and will require the most energy inputs?
Interesting. I think that the areas where you'd have to look at trade-offs would be things like precision agriculture. Are the gains, for example, in reduction of input use like nitrogen enough to balance, you know, say, increased use of machinery? So I think those would be where you'd have to look at what would be the net energy use equation. And then, of course, you have to trade that off with what are the other benefits in terms of yields and so forth. But yeah, for I think those would be the ones where you worry the most about the energy balance. Several of them, I think, are very much oriented towards improving the energy balance. So we didn't look specifically at that. You know, the nitrogen use efficiency, for example, where you could reduce very substantially the nitrous oxide emissions if you can get that right. Crop protection, again, we're looking here at across the board, not chemical crop protection, but also integrated crop protection. So I don't think there's necessarily a significant energy bill to that. So I think most of these are either positive or neutral in energy, I guess I would say. But again, that we didn't study that specifically except for a couple of technologies. Yeah.
Back over to our online audience.
This question comes from Jamie Montgomery, USAID Climate Change Advisor for DCHA Bureau. How did the model take into account the appropriateness of different technologies in different regional contexts? For example, the irrigation technologies discussed may not be as effective in some regions due to the level of operations and maintenance required.
Right. Well, yeah, so we did analyze them at this 60-kilometer by 60-kilometer level, so we took into account, you know, water balances in those regions, initial input use in each region, as well. So we did it, you know, account for that in the basic analysis using the crop modeling as to what are the actual conditions in terms of weather, soils, current fertilizer use, et cetera. The work on costs are embedded in the assessment of the adoption pathways.
Question over here. Yes.
Yeah. Hi, Pace Lubinsky from USDA. Mark, congratulations to you and your team on the study, and thank you to CropLife and USAID BFS for supporting such important work. I have two questions. Both I think folks have touched on in the Q&A, and you've talked to a little bit. The first question goes back to this question of adoption. And from my understanding, adoption of new technologies in Africa has been a challenge ongoing for many years, going back to the Green Revolution. So my first question is, what's different now if Africa is going to be adopting some of these technologies? Are you optimistic right now that this time around will be different? And then the second question is regarding the potential in Africa for transformation in terms of going from smallholder farmer to perhaps, and you touched upon this earlier, to, you know, do we really expect Africa to have 70-80% of its folks involved in agriculture by 2050, or do we also see a trend where there may be, you know, fewer smallholder farmers in the future? Thank you.
Yeah, those are great questions. I guess I would say I'm cautiously optimistic on the future of technology adoption more broadly in Africa than say 10 years ago. Partly, I think. Because the African decision makers and policymakers have taken ownership of the need. I mean, if there's one positive impact of the CADIT process, I think it's been developing a political commitment to some of these kinds of technological change that are necessary. It's not an easy process, and you know, so I don't want to just say jump up and down, it's going to be great. But I think there's reason for hope, and I think the recent round of work with AGRA and others have, I think, demonstrated a more realistic approach to the need to fine-tune recommendations to very specific regions. I think the Green Revolution kind of foundered in Africa because of the huge multiplicity of agroclimatic and weather zones in Africa compared to in Asia and parts of Latin America, where it was very successful. Those were relatively homogeneous growing environments in Asia, so that a few different varieties of rice or wheat could do very well very fast. You know, when you didn't get those quick gains in Africa, things sort of fell apart in terms of adoption of that round of technology. So I think in this newest phase, we need to, again, look at much more disaggregated technologies as we've done here. But even from what we've done, then has to be taken down to another scale locally to confirm the viability. So I guess a cautious optimism, but it's not like an easy thing, but I think it's moving forward. I think the smallholder question is a great one. I think, I mean, perhaps we spend too much time extolling the small farmer these days. I think over time, farm size is going to increase, if not the ownership size. I already mentioned it's happening in South Asia, and I think it's going to happen in Africa. The operational holdings are going to increase over time, so that you're going to see use of somewhat larger scale technologies than you're seeing today. Labor, you know, wages in Africa are very high in many regions. So you're already seeing a high cost of labor-intensive agriculture in Africa. I think there's going to be a movement, partly because of that, again, for a little bit of consolidation, a little bit more mechanization over time. And it's not going to happen overnight, but I do think, as I think you were implying, that there is going to be a change in that. And the overall transformation is definitely happening. You're going to see, like in Asia, shift of population, employment, and share of GDP to non-ag sectors over time. But there's still a long way to go on that, too. But that's definitely happening. Yeah.
Mark, I want to make sure that everyone is aware fully of the AgriTech toolbox and how they can experiment with the data themselves.
All right. So, yeah, together with this analysis, there is a tool that's been put on the website, which I don't have the link to, but can I send it to you and you'd be able to get it to the people? But you also can look on the IFPRI website I think it's currently under our Harvest Choice website, and then with a subheading for the AgriTech Toolbox that actually presents these results at the pixel level, so that you can go in and look at, well, if you want to look at this section of Tanzania, you can see what the results were for this region in Tanzania to look at those in more detail. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I should have done that.
All right, I think we have another online question.
Yes, this one comes from Samuel Letterman from BioVision Foundation based in Zurich, Switzerland. Beyond the negative or zero impact on yield outlined earlier by Mark with organic agriculture, it seems to be missing as a technology in further slides of analyses and also the online model. Since organic agriculture tends to be a hot or heated topic, I would be interested in asking Mark whether or not this decision was an easy one to make, since the data is quite contested or generally lacking.
Which decision, sir?
The decision to include organic agriculture.
Yeah, we wanted to look. I mean, as you said, it's a hot topic, so we wanted to see if our analysis would show positive or negative impacts, and it came out negative. I mean, given that the impact on yields is negative, there was then no point in analyzing an adoption pathway, a large adoption pathway, because in general it's not going to be adopted on a broad scale. It'll only be adopted where you have niche markets that afford a much higher price for organic products, as you see in the United States, Europe, and now very selected areas in developing countries. So there were. It wasn't logical then to say, oh, you're going to have 50% adoption of this technique that results in 20% loss of yields and incomes. So that's why then it wasn't appropriate to then carry that through and say that there is an adoption and so forth.
Got time for a couple more questions. I saw a hand here. Oh. You got it? All right, great.
Linda Staley with Global STI Consulting. I'm interested in this as you look at building global science, technology, and innovation collaborations. How, again, back to the question of scaling this up, how are the challenges in terms of getting buy-in from stakeholders, and where are the NGOs, which organizations globally are working on this, and how do you see the funding of the scaling up happening? Is it possible that governments could work more collaboratively and proactively to do this?
I think that's really the way it has to go. And again, I think, you know, we're now working in five countries in Africa on a related project, again, that's a USA-funded, USAID-funded project looking at a science platform, where we're developing in each of the countries basically the capability of doing somewhat simplified analyses along these same lines, but that would be available then in the different ministries involved in those countries. That, I think, would be very good to expand more broadly. We think we might be able to do that much more broadly in because of the new funding AID is also provided to AGRA to try to look at scaling up of these technologies and other technologies on a much larger scale in other countries. So it's going to take just a long-term effort working directly with countries. I think my impression is the scaling up strategy has not yet been defined enough to bring in, that say in this region we're going to work with CARE, or that region we're going to work with Oxfam or Conservation International. But I think those are the next step is to get that kind of partnership as well. I don't know, John, do you have any more knowledge on those or anybody else on the ID AGRA work and so forth?
See me flop around a little bit in this answer. It's certainly hard to generalize on kind of the types of partners because it's tremendously different depending on the particular commodities. We have, for example, the real effort of AGRA is on seed technology. So in the case where they're really looking hard at maize, it's very much a partnership with, kind of the small private sector. Those are their big partners providing support to make sure you can get good seed production of mostly hybrids, but also open pollinated maize. When it comes to, the more kind of more orphan crops, so working on a lot of legume crops, then it's a certainly a broader group of stakeholders that they're working with to get this out. Certainly the NGO community, the public sector that's in some of these focus countries for scaling.
Hello. Okay. Yeah. So I'm just interested in this as a model for potentially other sectors. I just lost my train of thought. At AID, I understand that you're in the pro. Oh, the timeline. I was curious about the timeline. Do you see this happening in the next 2 years, this sort of global scaling up? When are these seeds going to be ready? I'm curious. This is probably more a question to the speaker.
Mm. Well, I think some things are ready. I mean, there are some drought-tolerant maize varieties now in developed for specific African conditions that I think are scalable. But what exactly the adoption pathway would be the next 2 or 3 years, I'm not certain. But again, there are partnerships to produce the seeds, high-quality seeds. And distribute them. There still has to be, I think, a lot of information campaigns and demonstration, use of demonstration plots and so forth to show the effectiveness of these. So, but I think it's ready to scale up. It's not something that happens overnight.
I think Mark's exactly right. It's not a binary thing when it comes to, for example, the drought tolerance or the heat tolerance. We're kind of making sort of small steps year by year and getting materials out that are slightly more drought tolerant or slightly more heat tolerant. So it's not a yes or no. It's just to make that faster. Yeah.
Just one quick clarifying question. Mark, you were mentioning some countries that
there were scaling technologies that were happening. Can you specify which countries you were referring to?
Certainly India is doing quite a bit along these lines. More, it's not that they're being necessarily pushed, but the private sector there and the ag sector, is particularly in the Punjab area, for example, or some of the advanced rice areas in the south. It's really private farmers and working with extension agents as well are moving forward with some of these improved seed varieties and some of the more advanced technologies as well. There's some movement now in adoption in, I don't know where I would specify. I think Tanzania and Kenya are moving a little faster on for example, I'm looking at the drought tolerant varieties. Some parts of West Africa, like Burkina Faso, have moved forward on some of the crop protection issues as well. Let's see where else. I mean, South Africa, the Republic of South Africa is well ahead in some of these areas compared to some other parts of Africa. So I guess those would be some of the key ones. On irrigation technologies, Morocco and Tunisia have moved forward as well.
And then I've also got a couple quick technical questions. The first is from Steve Lynn, from an independent agribusiness consultant from Brattleboro, Vermont. Is the suggestion that drip irrigation is appropriate to cereals? I've only seen that used with high-value horticultural crops. And then the second one is about millet and sorghum. There are very important dryland crops. Are there any plans to look at these using your methodology?
So could you say the second one again?
It's about millet and sorghum and whether or not those will be part of your methodology.
Yeah. I mean, the second one, we'd love to extend this work. We don't currently have the resources to do it. We are working, though, with we are doing some separate work, though, with ICRISAT using a similar kinds of analyses to look at specifically at some of their millet and sorghum varieties. So, yeah, so I correct myself. We are, in fact, doing a similar analyses for that. I think some of the results would be available by the end of the year on millet and sorghum. There's highly selective use of drip and sprinkler for these field crops as well. I agree that in general, the biggest impact is going to be on high value crops, and the biggest adoption is going to be there in very dry areas and in second seasons. For example, in Asia, you do see sometimes use of these very relatively low cost plastic plastic tubing used to deliver water, for example, along furrows in maize or wheat fields. It's not the high tech kind of sprinkler or drip irrigation, but you are seeing some expansive use of that in quite dry areas for these kinds of crops.
I think we'll take two more in person before we wrap up. Go ahead, Fred.
Hi, Fred Smith from Insight Systems Corporation. I wanted to ask, within your 60 by 60 kilometer units of measure, were you looking at soils variability within those units, and how did you account for that? And has there been any attempt to take some of the DSAT results and overlay them with some of the digitized soil maps?
Yeah, in fact, the starting point was to calibrate the soil maps with the these areas. So we did do those overlays. Where we had the better data, what we had to do was end up taking sort of an average soil profile, and I agree that's not perfect. So, but we would have to try to get the average parameters for that 60 by 60 kilometer level, because we just didn't have basically the resources to do analysis at a lower level. But we did have lower level data where we did have good quality lower level data. We did try to take a sort of a weighted average for the where the crops were as well.
It's amazing you got to the 60 by 60 kilometer area.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sarah Durso from NCBA CLUSA. I just wanted to say I'm very pleased to learn about the individual technologies contribution to yields, because what we do in our projects with USAID Feed the Future projects is we tend to work with a package of technologies, conservation, agriculture. So it's good to know which of these individual techniques or technologies contribute the most in terms of impact on yields. I was just wondering, with regard to crop protection and soil fertility, Do you see any sort of way that working on increasing the soil fertility is impacting on increasing the ability to manage pests and weeds and things like that? And when you sort of disaggregate these two effects, you know, how is it that you can make a differentiation between the effects of soil fertility on crop protection and the other techniques on crop protection?
I mean, just technically, I mean, you hold in the modeling, it's not a great answer, but you hold those other things constantly. So you would hold the parameters for soil fertility constant while you implement the impact on crop protection as well. We did do a few combined scenarios also that are in the report that I showed. I can't remember, honestly, if crop protection crossed by soil fertility is integrated soil fertility is in there. In some of those, we got that the net effect was somewhat higher than the individual effects. So there were some synergies. In others, there didn't seem to be much additivity. And whether that's partly a limit of the ability of these models to capture cropping systems, or I'm not too sure. So, but there we could check on whether there is some if we looked at that particular combination.
We've got another question from Robert Navin from USAID Africa Bureau. Post-harvest losses are generally said to be about 30%. Have you looked at this, given that eliminating or reducing this would exceed the yield increases described in many of the technologies you researched?
We are starting another project to look specifically at post-harvest losses. My initial opinion from my reading is that the ability to gain through attacking crop losses is much less than some of the current literature is implying, which seems to imply that you can do it almost costlessly and that you can get all of that 30% as well. And clearly the economically attainable reduction in losses is much less than those total levels that you're talking about. And of course you need investments in technologies to do that too. So we are now starting to do some work on trying to look more specifically at what types of post-harvest technologies can reduce those losses, how much they can reduce it, and what the cost is. So we are starting that kind of work now. So we'll have results down the line. But it's a fairly early stage, and I think it's a very important issue. It's an important issue, but I'm afraid it's tended to be used now almost a political statement. Oh, you don't have to grow anything more because all you have to do is cut these losses, as if that's an easy thing to do. So I think it's going to be very important to get a clear understanding of the economics and just how much can be gained. Now, obviously, there are gains that can be made, but I think the cumulative gains from the kinds of technological change that we're looking at in this report are going to turn out to be much higher than the gains from post-harvest savings.
All right, we've had a ton of great questions today and a lot of great answers from Mark. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and wrap up. If you were able to fill out the survey on your chair, please feel free to either leave it on your chair or drop it up on this front table or even on the table that's out in the hallway. Those are really helpful to us. Please feel free to keep eating or take some of the pastries and coffee that are probably still in the kitchen over there. And we really appreciate your attendance at Ag Sector Council. Thank you.